24. I do social statistics. I don't do ethics. I do not do philosophy. Or I do cod philosophy. You're going to get some of that and you can tell me where I'm going wrong. I am interested in the politics of all of this. And I'm most interested in the statistics about the numbers of people. My worry is that, you know, perhaps the statistics shouldn't matter. We ought to treat people in particular ways, regardless of how many of them there are. But the statistics do appear to matter, in that we worry about huge numbers of people. If the reality is we're going to have far fewer people than we worry about, then, you know, maybe that could help quite a lot frame how we think about the future and how we think about things. But it does worry me, so I'm sure you can correct me. But, you know, I think even if we were in a planet that was absolutely exploding in population, we should still treat people in a way that would be the same as in a planet which I think is calming down dramatically. I did this book about 3 years ago called Population 10 Billion. If you look very carefully, you'll see people making people on the cover. That was not my idea, it was the publisher's idea. The 10 billion figure comes from UN projections, I'm going to show you something about, which are largely projections about aging. The main reason we might get to 10 billion is that us, the people of our ages, might get into our 70s and our 80s. That's the main driver of the population growth in the future. The minor one is people making people. The thinking about people as other, as not like us comes from the Population One book, which was a book published in 1968, which I think got it spectacularly wrong. Only a tiny number of people in 1968 realised what was happening and wrote in code. And it's very probable that only a tiny number of people actually understand what's happening now and will find out in the future who they were. It's just luck. The person who most, I think, got it right in around 1968 was a mathematician who said that the current population growth rates in the 1960s, within 300 years, the entire planet would be a seeming mass of human bodies, every piece of flesh touching other pieces of flesh. What that mathematician was actually saying in code in the 60s was, this population growth rate is highly unusual, there's no way it can carry on, we are in a peak. But he wasn't brave enough, I think, to actually say that. There's your 7.3 billion people. This is a map called a cartogram in which areas of all proportional population. I've been used to these maps for 30 years now. You probably have, most of you have seen this for the first time, and I'm getting worse and worse about being liberal, about giving people time to see it. But that's us, that's where we are. If you've had a screensaver like this for at least 20 years, which I have, what slowly happens is you begin to think of the world as being like this. You also, and you think of your trips when you fly, because I'm a very active person, I get to fly. I think about myself as flying over people, certain numbers of people. I also don't think about 7.3 billion as a particularly large number. It's a billion, just over a billion in India, a billion in China, a billion in the countries of Africa. Europe is small, Europe is peripheral, Europe always was peripheral. I mean, it really shouldn't have a name as a continent, you know, it's just part of Asia. Europe found itself in the centre of the world when we discovered the new planet, which was the Americas. Europe is disappearing onto the edge again. It's really easy to think there are lots of people. This is what Ehrlich did in 1968. I think he stood in the middle of sort of like Calcutta and said, you know, all around me there are masses of people, just there's too many. From the point of human beings, you will have seen lots of people this morning when you're coming here. When I was cycling over the cycle path in Oxford, there were too many bikes. The problem was we need to widen the cycle path, but it's not hard. Except, you know, it's amazing. You do better in Utrecht and other places. You wouldn't believe how difficult the authorities and the city of Oxford finally do things like widen the cycle track. But it feels like there are lots of people around you. This is the same kind of picture for Britain. This is a population map, areas we make proportional to people. And there are lots of people in London, and when they get out in the morning, they see the famous crowd of people in London, so it feels crowded. And, you know, there's Oxford. We're stuck between Birmingham and London. Hardly anything in between, because that's all the space without people that we don't see, because there's nobody there, so we don't realise it's empty. And we have this particular... that's what, you know...
Well, how's got Ireland?
Ireland, obviously, this political one. Ireland, on the large called itself independence. apart from that bit, which is still attached, which is largely Belfast. I'll bring you Ireland in, here we go, Dens Island, which is largely Dublin. People live in cities. We are largely London and a few northern cities and a couple of independent countries, which in the case of Scotland is largely Edinburgh and Glasgow. It's not a bit where not many people live. There's Europe, with that kind of strange lobster-coloured turkey-looking ominous kind of coming in. That's Istanbul. Greece is largely Athens. And if I've got a pointer here. Spain, you can see the size of Madrid. If we turn those, we're going to light off, but Paris, you can see the size of it. But that's people. That is just a way of seeing.
I'm not sure whether I really understand what it represents. So the bigger the squares that we had in the great urban with London, yeah, the more people, and the closer the lines, the less people.
Yes. So on a normal map, the squares would all be the same size.
Right, yeah.
Whereas here, we've got a grid, mm-hmm, on which is on the surface of the Earth, the lines are all straight, mm-hmm, and we've just bent the lines so that everybody gets the same amount of space.
Good. And the world map is like 7.3 billion.
Yeah, the world map is doing the same thing. It's a really fun and nerdy thing, if you like. I don't know why I'm telling you, because you're normal people and not like me. But the nice thing is every pair of lines still eats 90 degrees even though they're bent. So you can actually use this map to navigate around places. There's lots of good news stories. Often the good news is elsewhere. So this is data from 10 years ago about the rising renewable energy and green energy and windmills and so on, but it's just not the USA and not the UK where the majority of us in this room are from. There's very good news on population. This is data again from 10 years ago for Turkey, just showing you that only in the rural parts of Turkey are people producing over 3 children. A couple, Istanbul, had a lower fertility rate than London 10 years ago. We have a massive worldwide population slowdown. These are the UN figures that were produced in 2003. It's the first and the last time that the UN did projections going forward 300 years because the climate change scientists wanted them. That's in 2003, the projection was for 9 billion in the central projection. Simply based on what has been happening, people don't understand how dodgy these figures are. It's not the fault of the UN, there isn't a cleverer way of doing this. But the UN is just a small, you know, it's a dozen people doing it. The upper and lower projections are simply if the average woman had half a child more or half a child less, that's it. There's nothing sophisticated about the projections that everyone uses for the world. And why does it head off straight? Because they didn't want to scare people and actually have it going down, which is the more likely thing. So they made an assumption that in the future, under 20 years' time, we will all have exactly 2 children for some unknown, well, because it ends up with a figure that doesn't scare us too much. There's no reason why we should have 2 children on average in the future. But nobody knows. It's a brilliant document, the 2003 document, because they got at least 40 world demographers to write short commentaries at the end of it. So you can, in one document, you can see the sort of sum total of world knowledge about demography. And then, sorry, the other thing to say is that nobody ever looks at the bottom one. Okay, the bottom one is probably more likely, as I'm going to argue. People concentrate on the middle one and then they panic themselves about the higher one.
But life expectancy, would they assume people will have?
In the future.
Well, again, like this interval.
It gets to a point where it doesn't matter. So I think they would assume about 100, you know, 100, that kind of figure. But it wouldn't matter if it was 200, because eventually you get stability, as long as people die.
And that's our expectation that life expectancy expands over time as well.
There's an expectation of some expansion, but not huge amounts. So I think it's not greatly beyond. Demographers are obsessed by life expectancy. Particularly old paleontologists. There's so many papers on the idea of will it carry on, what point will it get to? My kind of take on it is that you get new diseases kicking. There's a lovely paper produced 20 years ago about diseases of the ninth decade of life. Once you get past the heart disease and the cancers, your internal workings, you're like a washing machine when your plumbing goes. It's pretty, if we do manage to get to 110, 120, it's pretty grim for most people. Most of us are going to get blind before we die already. That's awesome. Anyway, let's get off the. This is a form of riches. I mean, we shouldn't actually get depressed about this. The things that are going to go on in our lives, particularly the women here, because you're more likely, in our 90s and if you get past 100, it's not really worth sobbing about. But if we plan for it better, I think we'd have a more caring society if we actually realise what's going to happen to affluent people when they age. A year later, 2004, the UN offers their projection to 10 billion rather than 9, because there are a few more babies born worldwide. The lower projection goes to 6 billion rather than 5.5 for, 85 years from now. But this is only 85 years away. We have no idea what's going to happen in the lifetimes of people being born now in the world. The high projection is 15.8, and they added that extra one, 26 billion, assuming we suddenly stop having fertility decline to really scare people. And they stopped projecting for 300 years for the simple reason that you can't find a piece of paper big enough. You see what I mean? If you add that extra line, you end up at the moon on that graph. It's just silly. It really is as silly as I'm making all these tales. And it's affected by the politics of who controls the UN, who's influencing it, what kind of factors are at play. Then really annoyingly, in June 2013, they decided to increase it again to 11 million instead of projection. It's annoying because they did it a week before my book was published. And my book has 10 billion on the cover. You know, so it looks out of date already. So I'll try and show you why this happened. Why we go from 9, 10, 11 central projection. This is fertility rates as a real until about 2010 and then projected. You see all this projection heading towards 2. It doesn't upset people, but if you look at the better off countries of the world, if you look at Shanghai or Tokyo or Barcelona, you'll see that people actually need to one child, which is halving in the generation. I'm not saying we're going to go to one child, but I think it's fair to say the reality is going to be somewhere between 1 and 2, rather than 2. Africa doesn't. The slope for Africa is not as steep as the slopes for the other continents. Africa didn't slow down its population, particularly in the 10 years before 2000. These tiny things on the lines are the things that have the effect. So what happens in Africa in the future matters particularly, but if you ignore the line for Africa at the top one and just look at the rest of the world, you'll see how close we are already to 2, and the trajectory that's downwards. Many things in the affected countries in Africa. At the extreme, Nestlé just people up in nurses' uniforms and in baby milk increases the number of babies you get because you'll have slightly more babies if you're feeding your own baby with baby with a pail of baby milk rather than breastfeeding. But much more important, that bottom line there is the GDP collapse in Africa that occurred in the 80s and the 90s. When things go really, really badly wrong, you have more babies. This is when you have a war, you have more babies. When you have a famine, you have more babies. When you have pandemics, you have more babies. When you have social security systems fall apart and you have no pensions, you have more babies. When somebody draws a wall around you in Gaza, you have more babies. When things go right, people have fewer babies. This is the most important graph. This is the graph of the annual population change for the world from 1820 to roughly now. We've had an outlier of human beings. So it's like an outlier of what's occurred. The last time the population of humans on the planet went up sixfold, sevenfold, eightfold was the Neolithic Revolution, which was much longer when we moved from hunter-gathering to settling in villages. It was a similar worldwide increase as far as we can tell. That's the last time anything like this has happened. What's happened began in 1850, and that increase, it's like you're having savings in the bank, and that's the interest rate you're getting on your savings. So if you imagine interest rates coming up, can you imagine how high your savings get after 150 years? That's why we've had the rise. I think the most prescient thing is what Charles Darwin wrote in Origin of Species. And he wasn't writing it about human beings at all, he was writing it about different species and races. He talked about races of cabbages and what happens to cabbages. And there's a lovely phrase in the Origin of Species, and he says, a species can have a few favoured generations in which peculiar circumstances arise in which they have a population boom. I mean, the great irony is that Darwin was writing it at the beginning of the few favoured generations for humanity. The favouredness isn't actually something wonderful happened, it's something terrible happened. The terrible thing that happened is that societies worldwide were completely disrupted by people invading them with new ideas, methods and religions that completely upset stable social systems across the whole planet. It began in Europe with stable rural life being disrupted by the enclosures and the creation of cities, and in the cities you don't have population control, you have the village, you get more people. The discovery of the Americas suddenly allowed us to have somewhere to send. You know, we sent out millions and millions of people that we produced. Europe had the first population boom in the world. It coincides with capitalism. It coincides with money becoming more important than everything else. Population boom is very, very good for capitalism. You can sustain 2 or 3% GDP growth a year as long as your market is growing and other markets. It's very hard to sustain a profit year on year if you've got a shrinking market to sell to. Anyway, so we have that slope. Begins around about 1850 for the world, begins earlier, of course, in Europe. Four interruptions to it, which are almost like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I mean, pandemic and the First World War, but the pandemic was bigger. The Second World War, and then a huge baby boom with a return. Independence in India, revolution in China. The numbers are not well documented, but they may coincide. The Great Famine in China. And then it ends, 1968, 1971. Incredible, just stops worldwide. The best comment is the emancipation of women, half emancipation of women worldwide. That's the thing that fits when you see where it's happened. And how it's happened is helped by contraceptives, but contraceptives were not the key. We get the condom here, 1876, two people are put on trial in Britain for trying to distribute leaflets about condom in London. absolutely brilliant, best thing you've ever done, put them on trial. The middle class of Britain discovered the condom. 1877, we have our first baby reduction. And then the working class discovered the condom as well. So contraception is probably necessary. I don't believe human beings are that able to control themselves, but it's not sufficient. It's the growing power of women almost everywhere. Women tend to want half a child less than men, partly because the men don't actually have to have the child. Things about population just locally. These are graphs that the Office of Budget Responsibility produced in 2012, just showing how this country, if it does achieve the government's target of zero net migration, will be rampant. You can't have a debt with the has and not have people coming in to share it with productive. And the Office of Budget Responsibility is a very conservative boarding organisation. That's what's interesting about the pattern they produce things like this. These are worldwide changes. The graphs going down are the rapid reductions in people with no education whatsoever. Education means very little often. Just going to a school for one day counts you as educated by some of the statistics. The other line is in graduates, the two dark lines. It's a very, very rapid change we're going through. A largely illiterate world population to a largely illiterate population in just one generation. The most effective contraceptive in the world is a university education. You will not find undergraduates in this city in Ivy University carrying babies into lectures. As university education expands worldwide, the delaying of birth accelerates. And that is not being factored into future projections at all. Not many more of these. There's just a crude population growth rate. You can see how weakly they are until 2010, and the projections cause them all smooth. But all kind of heading towards zero for most areas. Go forward again. This is the only innovative thing I did in that book. So it's not that clever, but it shows you how unclever the national statistics are. If you have population this year and next year, say 7.3 billion and 7.4 billion, so going up by 100 billion in a year, the change is 100 billion. Suppose the change in the next year is 100 million, you take that away from the others, you find the change in change is zero. So this is a graph of the change in population. It's real data till 2010. I should say the data isn't perfect. I mean, lots of people dying around the world without being counted before. It's real data till 2010, and there's the projections. The interesting thing, if you look at the real data, is that the gaps between those peaks are 18 years and 22 years. So, if you say what we've actually seen in the world is a baby boom, and what you're seeing now are the echoes of a worldwide baby boom. The baby boom began in the 1950s. Then your projections would end up looking like that, rather than what the UN is actually doing, which is saying it will be steady in the future. And you can be more sophisticated and actually just copy the actual pattern on. There's nothing clever about this at all. It's just fake sophistication. It's been papers in Science which are no clever or more stupid than this, but they're published saying, you know, proud of 10, whatever. But if what has just happened has been the echo of a worldwide baby boom, and the UN democracy didn't notice it, which is why they've gone to 9, 10, to 11, we could end up with nearer to 7 and 8 billion people in 85 years. This matters because it's the first reduction in global population since the Black Death. And after the Black Death, the price of labour rose, human relations changed. We don't know. It can easily be upset. All it requires is war. We're still due pandemics. The richest 1% in the world taking more and more and more, getting lack of security for everything else. I mean, in that book, I found 44 things going on in the world that were worse than population. You know, species extinction, everything. You're really proud of yourself. But if it doesn't, if we carry on seeing a continuation of the emancipation of women, we see social security systems introduced in countries that don't have them. In rich countries, we control our greed a bit better than we have. If we also be able to do it, given we can send half the population to university now, the idea that, you know, the most educated population in Europe is going to be unable to control the greed of a few people. If we get increased ability, I don't think it would be wrong to imagine by the end of the century getting down to 8 or 7 billion people. It's all about how many children people now are choosing to have. For the marginal thing, we can project the ageing, and the ageing can only go on if we have a disease that particularly affects the very elderly. And the flu pandemics tend to affect the young who haven't been, haven't had a virus before. That little curve there, which I've drawn the question mark to, that is the possible baby boom that's just happened, which we may be overestimating. We'll know in the next 5 or 10 years. The problem at the moment is because of a worldwide economic recession, demographers go on, people aren't having children because things are so traumatic in the world, whereas they may just not be having children because there are actually less people of a particular age likely to have children, and then there'll be an increase again. Does it all matter? The additional people coming onto the planet, the mostly coming on in places where people are not burning carbon. 1 billion people behaving very badly is worse than 7 billion people behaving a bit better. We have huge variations in our pollution levels. You've had too many graphs, so I'm going to not talk about that. I was going to say, it's a graph that suggests, this is a growth rate over time, my area, and they go black and they go wrong in line with population going down. You cannot sustain ever-growing profits easily with declining absolute markets. You can't sell more bottles of Coca-Cola to people if there aren't more people. There's only so much Coca-Cola somebody can drink before they're sick. And furthermore, if you educate people more, trying to convince them, you know, it doesn't matter how much money WPP spend on advertising about drinking sugar is going to be good for you. There comes a point. Okay, so you move off Coke and you sell people something else. But our basic model of selling has been large numbers of ignorant consumers buying things they don't really need. So it's interesting what's going to happen in the future. I just put these last two graphs in because I like them. And I think it matters because we're in the UK. If you compare rich countries, the rich countries with the lowest fertility rates tend to be more equal ones, in places like Japan. The rich countries with the highest fertility rates are the most unequal, so the US has only just got itself below 2 children per couple. And there are numerous relationships with economic inequality in rich countries that aren't just fertility. One is ability at things like maths and literacy and problem solving. So these are PISA results on average maths ability measured at age 15, quite recently, 2012, for the richest countries on the planet. That ratio at the bottom is how much more money the best off 10th have than the worst off 10th per year. So in the US and UK, the best off 10th of us, I'm in there, are getting 15 to 20 times more disposable income than the poorest. Very different in Japan and Sweden. We tend not to be as good at maths and education in the unequal countries of the world. But the really fascinating thing is that when you test people at 16 to 24, a few years after they've done their school maths exam, we're really bad. Because in what we do in the more unequal countries is we teach people how to pass an exam, because we're very competitive. We have to get you out of your maths. We don't actually teach people maths. In the more equal countries, they actually teach people better, so they can still do maths. And this does matter for worrying about world population, because if you've got a set of academics sitting in countries that's awfully badly taught, who think they're very, very clever because they're in Oxford University, I just think we need to worry about that. And we believe in competition and so on. And we could do a lot. We should look more at those countries which are ahead in terms of fertility reduction, school systems, lower rates of pollution than the UK and the US. We've had a terrible tradition of telling the rest of the world what to do. You know, Rockefeller Institute from the US telling people how to behave. And I'm sure the English has been far worse, you know, having an empire and so on. And so, you know, William Beveridge gives advice on populations. People like him should have four children because of the base, because he has better genes. So those people in India shouldn't reproduce. In the event, Beveridge had no children whatsoever. Last graph on this, just showing you the variation. That's the same inequality score at the bottom. Oh no, it's different. It's what the best off 1% take. So in the US, the best off 1% take 20% more income in the US. In the Netherlands, it's just over 5%. The figure on the side is the proportion of the population walking or cycling to work. Yeah, so almost 50% in the Netherlands. And the point of putting this in is it's not individual action. You can only walk or cycle to work if your society arranges housing and jobs so they're near each other. Has to build cycle lanes, has to control cars, has to have public transport. And on the bottom are things like alcohol and cigarettes, which do not correlate with inequality, individual decisions. Obesity does, because it's hard to be thin in the US and the UK if you're sitting in a car for 3 hours commuting. It's a brilliant way to not use up any calories. So there are all these things going on in rich countries, which are useful to look at, because the rich countries are the low fertility countries and the countries which other countries appear to be behaving like. If other countries had to be more like Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, France, and the Netherlands, you've got a much more sustainable future for the planet. If other countries follow the US and UK, you ought to go to burn the planet up and have more babies. That's the wealth distribution in the UK, according to ONS, which is just ridiculous now. And finally, some more of these pictures. This is the first world map we did, where we took the skyline picture. So you'll have seen this picture on a normal map. And when you see it on a normal map, what you think you can see is where people are. So where it's light, there are people, and where it's dark, there aren't people. When you put it on this map, there are people everywhere. So if it's dark, it's where people either didn't have much electricity in the past, or were not so stupid that there were shining lights up in the sky, so somebody could take a satellite image. And this is all wasted light. The most wasted light a few years ago was in Tokyo. If you've been to Tokyo, you've seen all wasted light. When the tsunami hit, electricity production fell by 25% because they turned all the nuclear power stations off. Nobody died. So they worried that the air conditioning would matter in the summer, but it didn't. They turned the lights off. If you walked upstairs, you can use the lifts. You can actually reduce consumption.
What are the light lines? The sort of greyish, smeary lines?
Oh, the grey, smeary lines. That is where there's a very fine grid, rectangular grid on that, the original grid, the latitude and longitude. And where in the Sahara, the very fine lines get really stuck together because there's nobody.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's showing you the deserts, it's showing you the jungles in Africa, it's showing you the Himalaya, and it's showing you there's the spine of mountains in the Americas. Last picture. So if you look at Tokyo there. Tokyo is now relatively dimmer compared to other parts of the world, but Cairo's on a lit up, so it's kind of like not good news. But yeah, there were only 7.3 billion of us. There may be another couple of billion of us, but we've really worried ourselves, I think, far too much about this. We are aging rapidly in half the world. We are aging in Europe. We tend not to try to think about what happened to us in our 70s, 80s and 90s. But if we have people caring for us who are well looked after themselves, our individual selfish old age could be much more pleasant. And this is all about people in the better off temper of society. But please tell me where I'm going wrong, what's weird about what I'm saying, why I'm stupidly optimistic, how the rest of the population hates immigrants, and you know, I'm just a hippie in a nice house in Oxford, and I'm okay.
So, how
are
doubts about two things? One is, what is the explanation of the correlation that you mentioned? Between bad things happening and people having more babies, no? Because over the years I've read different explanations of this correlation. The first one in Joshua De Castro, the Council for Food and Agriculture, he wrote this book, it's called The Geography of Hunger. And so he says it's a biological effect when you are almost dead, so the body reacts and so you ovulate more, or some, you know, reactions in the body to increase sort of female fertility, and so people have more babies. Wilkinson and Pickett have a similar view in the spirit level, but in between there were other different psychological explanations of, you know, fear, people being trapped in elevators, wanting to cross the whatever. And so I don't know if you have a theory about what is this correlation.
Okay, I think there should be different theories. So at the extreme, where people are put into terrible situations, they may behave in certain ways. This is rare. The thing that's most interesting about extreme stress is how you get more female babies than male. So we don't have our biological things. Human beings and all mammals produce more females when they're stressed than males, because females are safer. I think, apart from the extremes, and the extremes include finding babies in refugee camps at a high number, but it really is 0.1% of the human population in these situations. The main driver on how many children people have is how many children other people are having. What's the social norm around you? And that alters our behaviour dramatically quickly. So you'll hear in this city people talking about how they cannot afford to have a child, because it's normal, and in many ways correct, to talk about that. When I talk to people in the generation above me, they say they could have a child, you know. It would be hard work. Very hard work if you're in a rented flat or so, but you actually could if you really wanted one. So what's stopping people from having those chances has become normal to have fewer children, and also not to have a child because you have a degree of security where you at least think if that child goes to school, they can go to the same school and they can move around. So I think the norms changing matter, and this is the key thing about one or two children. There's something very different about moving from, say, six children to four than moving between one and two. One and two is qualitatively different. In Japan, where it's normal to have one, you have one that you can see on your bike, everything's geared up to having one child in Japanese cities, and it's hard to have two. The other thing which I haven't talked about at all is people not having children. That's a quarter now of all adults in the UK. Half find they can't have children, the other half have actually chosen not to have. But it's social norms and what's expected of you. So my parents' generation, you were expected to produce children in your 20s. And if you were a good middle, upper middle class people person, you should produce four. The Queen did four, she was very beautiful. Yeah. my mum thought she ought to have four, so we ended up with four. You know, and that's Beth, which is four children for the race, except two of my brothers weren't white.
But the logical explanation is not implausible, because in primates it happens. For example, the age at which a chimpanzee female starts to ovulate depends on social conditions. When is the right time?
Yeah.
When things are improving for you, then it makes sense to have babies, because it's not good to have babies at age 13. So it's better if you can afford to wait your way. So women are now waiting because they are getting careers, they are getting promotions, they are getting stable jobs. They wait. Sometimes they wait so much that it becomes too late. No?
Yeah.
And so that theory would explain why some people are having children at 40, at that age they cannot, so they have zero. And why in situations like pockets of poverty with drugs, crime, you know, that you get all these teenage pregnancy because things are not getting better as they get older.
So in the UK has the highest teenage pregnancy rate in Europe. So you're talking about two girls in Oxford. Yeah, it's actually tiny. And there's two girls in 19. You know, that's, the vast majority of teenage mums are 19. They're only just teenagers. It's really disappeared. But it's because it's a staple of journalism to talk about. And it's really hard for journalists because there are so few teenage mothers now. So we can say the highest rate in Europe, and we can say, I don't know, Hull has the highest number in Britain. But the point is, never don't say actually it's just 20 girls, and give it a month and they're actually 20 years old. It's going away. The other side of it is that, the worrying thing is that this is an age at which we are designed to have children. So there's been studies of sisters in America that have found that the sister that had the child as a teenager is often the more competent one than the sister who didn't. They're both in a poor economic situation, normally. We're now doing a very strange thing of pushing our fertility into our 30s and early 40s. The babies tend to be healthy, there's a scare about whether you'd get more unhealthy babies, but the parents are absolutely knackered, because your body changes so much between 19 and 30, just biologically. But I think we're doing something very strange about it. And then when people of my age will begin to kind of quietly complain about how hard it is to be a parent, it is partly hard to live towards my parents. Because you're older. It's very similar to drinking. When you're 19, you can drink an awful amount and get a slight hangover for a couple of days out. If I do that now, the effect's awful for a week. The amount of energy of looking after a small child that wakes you up at night in a kind of Guantanamo Bay way. But I can still remember. I think it's a fascinating one, but it's new. We haven't done this before so late for so many. The average age, I think, of first birth is now 13 months.
In the UK?
In the UK, and it's older in Europe, slightly older.
Across the entire population?
Across the entire population, so it's bimodal in the UK. It's going up really rapidly in the last 4 years, but that fits with the crash. You know, so young people in Europe moving around between countries trying to find a job, having to stay with their parents, can't move out. It's had a particular effect that's slowing down. But then lots of people just walked in. Get onto migration. It's quite an incredible coincidence of just at the time when Europe really isn't, reproducing itself, it gets all of its biggest migration streams coming.
So I loved your optimistic population projection. You know, I want to go home and tell my kids, now they can give me all these grandchildren, and they're all set. The trouble with that is, not everyone agrees with you. And I realize you said you and figures are dodgy. But, you know, I don't think they went out on the sidewalk in New York and it was really crowded, so they, you know, it's not the Paul Ehrlich standing in Calcutta's story. So they have reasons.
So I find myself thinking, well, there are a lot of pessimistic projections. There's at least one relatively optimistic projection. Maybe there are others. And then I think, well, ethically, what should I do? And I find myself thinking I ought to prepare for the worst case analysis. You know, not if it's totally crazy, some crank in the street, but, you know, if a bunch of experts are making a negative that is a projection with unfortunate outcome, that I ought to think, well, best case, worst case, if the worst case is sufficiently probable and sufficiently harmful, then I should plan around that. Maybe it will turn out not to be necessary, just like wearing my seatbelt isn't usually
necessary. That's planning for 15, 20 billion. So what you do then is you build walls, you get a frontier force, you lock yourself in. That behaviour will get you the worst case scenario.
Well, I don't, okay, maybe not, I wasn't looking at their worst case, I'm looking at their median projection, you know.
Yeah.
So...
Or the 9, 10, or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a case where it's all is lost, that would be yet another thing I should plan around, I guess. But yeah, looking at negative and more optimistic, I think I need to be cautious.
But it's not, 11, 12 million is fine, I mean. 7, 8 is fine, 6 is fine. We made numerous mistakes since Malthus of thinking we could work out an optimal population. The optimal population for the US was 136 million. So the US apparently now is a complete mess because it can only take 136 million people. That was what the first optimum was calculating. They're all terribly, terribly wrong. The world could house this number of people pretty easily. It, the amount of space required to grow food is very small, not negligible, but the brilliant thing about food is that you can't eat that much without getting very ill. We'd be in trouble if people could eat 20 times more than people. We're urbanizing, so we're actually using up less space. If we urbanize well, it can be efficient and leave people have got somewhere to go. I don't see 12 as bad and 7 as good. It's easier to see, and also we don't have that much control over it, but if we behave in certain ways, we'll get more people.
Okay.
One of the factors is migration. So when people come to rich countries, they're happier children. So if we stop migration, we'll get more people as well.
More for migration. But again, you know, you're saying 12 billion wouldn't be so bad. And again, other people say, well, it would be so bad. It's not just food, of course, it's, you know, other resources as well. We've done very well with food. It's part of why Paul earlier was wrong. He thought we'd all be starving. And so again, I find myself thinking, well, I don't know. I can't do these figures. And so it behooves me to try to, especially when I'm considering someone else's welfare, to be cautious. To do what I think will bring about the smaller figure instead of just thinking, oh well, it's all, you know, it's a done deal, we're going to be okay.
Yeah. Okay. Somebody wrote this on about a year ago about saying that having a baby is equivalent to taking a shopping trip to New York every year. If you worry about other people's welfare, don't fly to New York to go shopping. Look at your behaviour in terms of what you are consuming and the promotion of consumption. Ask why are all of us not looking at the WPP, the world's biggest advertising agency? Look at their website. It's truly frightening. Their entire purpose is to get people to buy things they don't want.
Well,
so we should worry about that. An extra grandchild or two is minimal compared to the effect you could have by trying to help graduates who are going into a business to try to get people to buy stuff that nobody needs to produce.
If we can do that effectively, yeah. And I do agree there are lots of things we should do.
Yeah, I think I want to make some. I'm conscious down the time, so I think Ingrid and Anka have questions.
Yeah, so my question immediately follows up on one of Sarah's questions, which is, can you describe to me, so it's about this alleged trade-off between the standard of living. I'm using the term the standard of living for material aspects of the quality of life, so not other aspects of the quality of life, like quality of social relationships, etc. So among philosophers working on climate ethics, there is this general, I think I can say generally accepted claim that there is a trade-off between the number of people and the standard of living, assuming that you want to say stay under 2 degrees warming of the earth.
Yeah.
Do you think there is no such trade-off, or do you think that the quality of the standard of living we could have with 11 or 12 million people would be really quite a decent life? So I'm trying to imagine how that life could be. So would we all have the lives of, say, people who live in Rwanda now, or southern Italy? So definitely not the US or the Netherlands. But what kind of life would be, if we were to be fully equal with 11 million people, what kind of life would we have?
What could we have? I don't believe in iPads. So iPads is this formula.
Yeah, yeah.
The reason I don't believe in it is you can put something in like the murder rate, and you can just say, the more people you have, the more murders you'll get. Which actually is not what's happening. So you can do the IPAP formula with anything and just say the more people, the more bad stuff you'll get. But it doesn't work. So that's the material standard of living. It's all about the warmth people could have. We can house people and insulate things with a degree of warmth which is far less wasteful than we currently have. With less effect on the climate and with more people. It would help if our population expansion could be around sources of water and in river valleys and in the right places and not where you need desalination plants. It would help if our growth in population could coincide with a growing realisation that increased material goods doesn't make you happy. And in those parts of the world where they've realised not to buy more. We've already passed peak consumption in some ways, but
that consumption is too high. So yeah. I can imagine that you could have if you can just stop consumerism at this high level. So let's say, like, I think we could convince many people that shopping trips by plane to the US is just, well, let me just say, immoral. But there's still something else from convincing people they can't have, say, foreign holidays.
Yeah.
And that's all impacting on the environment. So that for me, so I'm trying to kind of understand how these lives look like.
I mean, half our shops are clothes shops. The average item of clothing is worn only 12 times in Britain before it's thrown away. Other countries are much better at buying less, higher quality, living with their clothes for longer. We can have a dramatic effect on clothes. The travel's really difficult, the travel's the hardest. You can also get people to give up cars, and they do in Japan. The really hard one is telling people they can't travel and experience things. I think what you can do is explain how interesting it is to travel not that far. For instance, when I was in Sheffield, one of the few very rich schools used to send its children to the Himalayas on a field trip, but they'd never been to the other side of the city. You know, they learn more from just walking across the city. I think we need to allow young people to have very slow long distance travel, which takes time. My fantasy is giant helium balloons. They're 3 months to get to New Zealand, but you can still get to New Zealand. I think you've got to. None of this, of course, will happen. But if you don't offer utopian visions of the future, that's
possible. I fully agree, but I'm trying to figure out what is a realistic utopia with 11 billion people and what kind of standard of living we could have with 11 billion people. And there I don't know, but I am.
Yeah.
I found, if I can honestly say so, I would want to believe what you say, but I found it really very optimistic, because we have so many people in severe poverty.
But
billions of people in severe poverty, they don't even have decent food.
I know, but we're choosing to do that. So we have a billion who are hungry, and we have almost a billion who are, myself included, who are eating too much. You have to try very hard not to have that extra bit of cheese at night.
Yeah.
You know, this is a solvable problem. It's not an easy one to solve. If that cheese was really good for me at 11 o'clock last night, it would be much harder. But
it is for you.
It's really for you. You're young. Yeah. 11 doesn't seem high to me. But we have been immersed in an education. Geography students who are taught in their A levels that 5 billion is the number that the planet should have. Because somebody made it up. But so I teach generation after generation undergraduates, so I say, how many people from the planet are playing? And they go, 5 billion. Mm-hmm. So I went, why? And they go, don't know. And I go, you call that an education? You know what? How does it tell you? I can see what the numbers are worrying, but maybe the more important thing in the moment about 11 billion people is to look at Asian cities, which may be the future, maybe ahead of Western cities, and just say, people are actually choosing not to have 2 children, they're choosing to have 1. In 50 years' time, we could be talking about the dire lack of young labour in the world and how we allow a population to slow so fast. It's not impossible. I'm not saying we should have pro-natal policies or anything about it, but we should at least keep in mind that the parts of the world that are kind of ahead in time, you know, where the technology is faster, where the lives are brighter, are heading towards one child, and in many cases these are Asian cities, not the US or European ones. It is the parts of the world, only the parts of the world where Saudi claims of bombing people in Yemen, that people are still having 7 children. The few countries with 6, 7, or 8 children are in absolute terrible temporary situations involving war plans. That's the only way you can get people have 6, 7, or 8 children nowadays. So, one last one?
Yeah.
Question. So I knew about the contraceptive effects of education, but I don't know much about the correlation between having security nets like welfare states and people going for fewer children. Is there a strong correlation? Really?
I think it began with Bismarck and pensions in Germany. And it fits with in the US people having more children. It's not just immigration to the US. It's, you know, if you've got a welfare system which doesn't pay you unemployment benefits continuously or sickness benefit when you're not working, then the correlation fits. Mm-hmm. The Brave New World we don't know about is when people who won't have children, which is currently a quarter, may easily go up to a third, how they will see their relations with their nieces and nephews and friends' children, you know, kith as well as kin. Because this is a recent change from having a large related family, which most of my grandparents had, to everybody wants a group of 20 or 30 people. But most of our children's groups of 20 or 30 people are going to have to be unrelated people that they get on with.
Yes, so I wanted to follow up Ingrid's question. So my impression would be so I want to know whether this is correct, that it's probably easier to have everybody have a very good life in a world with 7 billion than to make sure that everybody has a very good life in a world with 11 or 12 billion. And that would be one reason to say, well, we should try to realize the one with 7 or 8 billion rather than the one with 12, even though both are feasible and both maybe could keep us above some sort of sufficiency threshold. The effort is going to be bigger in the 12 billion people world than the 7. So I don't know what you think about that, but that's my idea.
I would go for that. It's easy to sell and it's more intuitive. My worry about it is that the biggest improvement in human living standards occurred when we did have incredible population explosion. So when we went from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 billion, we also saw infant mortality rates plummet. And there was a year, 5 years ago, where it fell by 5% in 1 year. You know, one of the worst things that can happen to you is a child dies. And reduction in children dying occurred at so just thinking that a slower population growth rate would be better didn't fit with what has happened. It makes intuitive sense. I just wouldn't. There were 44 things much more important than population growth than out of money about. There are at least 44, including the coral reefs going. This is one of our smaller problems, and we, the reasons why we couldn't worry about it so much, the reasons we should still worry about it, is this facility to find stops. But the, you know, the only way to stop the decline is if we suddenly decide, you know, all our colleges are going to go all mad again. You know, from a crazy women have got to go and marry us when you're 10 years younger than us and look after the kitchens they can produce. You know, we have to do the most draconian change in politics to actually get up to 2 or 3 or 4 children again. Thank you for being patient.
Thank you. Thank you.